Hi, I'm Ken Harbaugh, former U.S. Navy pilot and host of Warriors in Their Own Words. Our mission here is simple, to preserve stories of service and sacrifice from America's warriors. Through archival interviews with veterans from World War II up through modern-day conflicts, we present firsthand accounts of what it takes to defend a nation. This is the unvarnished, unsanitized truth from those who lived it. This is Warriors in Their Own Words.
As soon as it got to be night, Carlson sent the advanced troops, and they began to cut like a rabbit hole under the brush. It was cactus, you know, like this kind of cactus you see in the cowboy movies. And all 800 Marines went through that little tunnel, through the cactus, through the grass, and out of sight. And in the morning, but it came morning, there wasn't a Marine left there. There wasn't a Raider left. This guy said, where did they go? Where'd they go?
Today, we'll hear from William Lansford. Lansford served in World War II with the Marine Raiders, a special ops force that specialized in guerrilla warfare.
A Marine Raider was a necessity that came up shortly after Pearl Harbor, when we were more or less, as they say in boxing parlance, riding our bicycle around the ring, you know, so that the other guys couldn't catch us. But at that time, you know, the morale was very low. We'd gotten clobbered at Pearl Harbor, and we didn't have the men or equipment ready to really counter effectively. Yet there was a need to build the morale of the country, of the people, and so the Raiders were created for that purpose. And we were patterned on the concept of the British Commando. And in the early days, when they decided to do the Raiders, when President Roosevelt gave the okay, the men who were going to lead the Raider battalions, you know, at that time chiefly Carlson, Evans F. Carlson, and Edson, who was forming the first Raiders in the East Coast, sent some of their officers and NCOs to England to train under the commandos, and came back and taught us some of that stuff. And then these men who were very experienced, both Carlson and Edson, who had served in the Banana Wars and knew what guerrilla warfare meant. Carlson had also served in China with the 8th Red Army. They began adding their own touches to the Raiders. You know, the configuration was what was needed. You know, would we be able to pull some quick raids and get out of there before they caught us? And the idea was really, I think it's a morale building and media catching sort of, and that's basically what we were meant to do. And to sort of like, you know, hold the enemy off at arm's length while the regular Marines, you know, got up to strength. I'd always wanted to be in the military, and a lot of depression kids went into the CC camps here in California, I suppose all over the country. So I dropped out of school and went into the CC camps. And it was a great place to train young guys, you know, 16, 17 years of age, to go right into the service. And this is, we're talking 1938, 39, when the war was on already in Europe. So when I got out, I tried to get in the Marines, and I was too skinny, and they wouldn't take me. And I tried to get in the Navy, and they wouldn't take me. Nobody would have me. I was underweight and skinny looking, and even though I'd been in the CC camps and was doing, I was a lumberjack there. Sounds silly. But anyhow, I was coming out of the Marine Corps recruiting office in downtown LA for the umpteenth time, and I saw this great, big, massive-looking guy with all kinds of gold stripes and all. He was a Marine sergeant. And he said, you know, he said, "You've been hanging around here a lot, son." I said, "Yes, sir." "You're trying to get in the Marines?" "Yes, sir." He said, "Any luck?" "No, sir." He said, "I'll tell you what." He said, you go down to Inglewood. There's a reserve company there. There's a reserve unit there, the 13th Machine Gun Battalion Reserves." He said, "You go there and sign up." And he said, "In 2 weeks, you'll be in the Marine Corps." So I did that. I went and I came to Inglewood and I signed up there. And they issued me a uniform and a rifle and all that stuff. And almost 2 weeks to the day, they mobilized us. And we're talking 1940 now. And in 1940, I ended up in the Marines. And directly out of boot camp, they had a list on the bulletin board. You could sign up to go to China, or you could sign up to join the 6th Marines and regiment, which was forming then. And I signed up to go to China because every Marine and sailor wanted to go to China. That was the place to be. Well, guess where I ended up? I ended up in Iceland. I got back from Iceland 10 months later and went into the, and they isolated us in this camp back in the U.S. They put us in, I think it was Camp Elliott, and they put us in this isolated camp. We couldn't get out of there, and we had nothing to do but hang around the barracks all the time, and we began hearing about this outfit, you know, called the Raiders and the Commandos, and they said it was a suicide outfit, and the guys that volunteered were volunteering to die, and all sorts of melodramatic stuff. So another guy and I got very curious. Yeah, I had very bad luck with top sergeants in those days. I was a PFC, and I thought, well, if I can get it out of this outfit, you know, I'll be ahead of the game. So I went to the sergeant and I said, we would like to apply for this Raider, this commando outfit. And he said, "Get back to the barracks and don't bother me, you know. They're all filled up." And that's what we'd heard, that they had filled up because they had been recruiting while we were en route back. So this guy and I decided that night we would sneak off and go see what we could find out about this guy Carlson we'd heard about. And we looked around the back of the camp out in the boondocks, and there was this great big old beat up looking barracks, and there was a guy standing there, and we said, "We're looking for Carlson." He said, "He's in there." So we went in there, the guy and I began going in all these empty rooms. This is an old beat up place, and I opened an office, and there's this tall-looking Lincoln-esque kind of a guy in a Marine uniform. He's sitting there at a little crappy table, and he's writing something in a notebook. And he looked up, and he said, "Can I help you, son?" I said, "I'm looking for Major Carlson." He said, "I'm Carlson." He said, "What can I do for you?" I said, "I want to join the Raiders." So he said, "Sit down," and we began to talk. And, you know, he said, "We're all filled up, you know. We got a lot more men than we need." And I said, "Well, that's not fair because we just got back, you know, and I'd like a shot at it." He said, "Okay, you have a point." And then he began asking me questions, you know, "Would you cut your buddy's throat if he was panicky behind the lines?" And stuff like that. It was fairly melodramatic stuff. And I answered what I thought he wanted to hear. Then I got out of there. He said, "You'll hear from us in a day or so. You go back to your unit." So when I got out, my buddy came out too, and he had run into James Roosevelt in another room on the other side. And he had gone through the same routine: "Would you stab a Japanese in the back? Would you do this? Would you do?" And he'd answer yes. But we found out later a lot of guys would say, "No, I couldn't kill my best buddy." So they would say, "Thank you very much, go back to your unit." I got back, and sure enough, the first sergeant was waiting for us. He said, "I thought I told you eight balls not to leave this camp." He said, "Okay, get back to your quarters and I'll take care of you." So I thought, well, court martial. The next morning, a guy comes running out and he says, "Lansford, pack your sea bag." He said, "Right away. Here, there's a truck waiting for you guys out there." He told the other guy, too, "There's a truck waiting for you out there." So we were already packed. So we just got out there into the company street, and there's the first sergeant. And he looked at me, you know, like this. And we got up on the truck. And as the truck started up, he said, "I hope you get killed." That's how I started my war. Next thing we were at Jack Swaim training with the Raiders. We had heard a lot of stuff by that time about the Raiders, you know, because the newspapers were trying to find out what was going on, and it was very hush-hush and all that. Basically, we moved into this great big empty boondocks, you know, where they used for a tank park. The Marine Corps would park its tanks there one time. It was called Jack Swaim. Anyway, I was assigned to a company, and with a whole bunch of people I didn't know, and we were indoctrinated. That was the first thing. Carlson brought us together, and at that time I think he was a major. He had just come back into the Marines, and he was a major, and he and Jimmy Roosevelt had built like a little platform, and they would get up there, and then they would call it what we call a gung-ho meeting. Later on became a gung-ho meeting. And they would explain what our objectives were, and they were terrific. You know, they would give you a whole indoctrination and tell you why we were doing these things. And also tell you not to believe all that nonsense, you know, that we would be relatively safe if we learned the principles of guerrilla warfare. And we were armed, and they had a lot of experimental weapons there. And we were told that there would be no saluting. Everybody was of equal rank, regardless of whether they were captains, lieutenants, anything. We'd call each other by our first names. And instead of saluting, whenever two men met, they would instantly go for their guns. And they would snap at each other, you know, pull the trigger to see which one would win. There were a lot of arguments. "I got you first. No, I got you first." And you know that. But we averaged about 18, 19 years of age. Anyway, there was, during the training, there were casualties. There were about three guys that I can remember. One of them got shot through the jaw. Another guy got shot in the belly. You know, because when we would snap shoot, sometimes there's always some dumbbell, you know, who forgot to unload his weapon. But the old man considered that to be part of the training too. You know, you had to know what you were doing. And because he always stressed that in combat there would be no second chances. And he was right, as always. The training never stopped. I mean, Carlson and Roosevelt believed that you couldn't be overtrained. And we continued training even after we left Jack's Farm, and we shipped out overseas and went into various staging areas. We continued the training all the time, constantly. You had to be on your toes, because the kind of stuff that they were teaching us, like sneaking up on people and like grabbing a guy from behind and throwing him, or like defending yourself against, Carlson was an early adherent of Asian or Oriental, as we call it then, combat, you know, close combat, close contact combat, because as it was proven later on, you know, that did happen more than people suspect. And he wanted us to always be very keen. It's like going to judo lessons. Now, in those days, jiu-jitsu was considered some crazy Oriental thing that white guys didn't do, you know. But he believed that you did do it, and that was the kind of training where you had to, like a good boxer, you always had to keep that edge. So the training never really ended. The purpose of the gung-ho meetings was to indoctrinate us, as I said earlier, and part of that indoctrination was philosophical. Now, later on, Carlson was accused by a lot of jealous establishment Marines, I'm sorry to say, you know, generals, colonels, people who were really jealous of this man and actively hated him, you know, sometimes. He was accused of being a commie, a pinko, you know, being more Chinese than American and all that nonsense, because he had spent a lot of time studying the Chinese tactics, marching with Mao and the 8th Red Army. He had made that 1,000-mile march with the Chinese. But the fact of the matter was that I think if you put him up against President Roosevelt or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln, I mean, you would have a guy that fitted in perfectly. His father had been a Congregationalist minister, and Carlson really believed in God, but I mean, really, he was a real Christian in the sense that he loved people and he protected people. And as far as being an American, I'll tell you, our gung-ho meetings open by singing, we sang the Star Spangled Banner. That was the first, that's how we opened them. And we closed them by singing Onward Christian Soldiers. And during the course of it, we pledged allegiance to the flag. Now, how American can you get? Carlson explained the time that he talked a great deal about the time he had spent with Mao's guerrillas and the tactics that Mao's guerrillas had used, and in order to defeat the Japanese. One of the reasons why Carlson had gotten out of the Marine Corps was because he was actually, and this is something that a lot of people didn't know, he was actually acting as an American agent for President Roosevelt and discovering all that he could unofficially about what the Japanese were doing in places like China, you know, places where they had already invaded. And Carlson was studying the Chinese. For example, one of the stories he told us about this one night when he was with Mao's guerrillas, and they got word that they were going to attack a Japanese convoy. He said that early that evening they took off, you know, trotting, half running, half walking, with all this equipment, because they had nowhere to run. They covered 50 miles. At dawn, they attacked the enemy convoy. They just chopped it to pieces, and before the Japanese could reinforce, get themselves reorganized and come after the Chinese, they'd gone back. They arrived back at their base the following day. I mean, in one day they had gone, they had destroyed a convoy, and they had run back, and this was all done on foot. And this is what he said, this is what you have to do. He would sometimes get us up early in the morning while it was still dark, and he'd say, boys, we're going to do 20 miles with full packs, all weapons, helmets, everything, no breakfast until we get back. And off we'd go. And we'd do the 20 miles and get back. I couldn't do 2 miles today. But that's the kind of a man he was. And I mean, dedication plus. He would make a brief address, and he would tell us what the objectives were. He would give us what amounted to a geopolitical analysis of what was going on at that time, you know, in various parts of the world, and how that affected our mission. He would explain to us, well, he said, I went to see Admiral Nimitz, and I said to him, we're ready, Admiral, we're waiting, what can we do, and so forth. But the reality was that the establishment didn't really know how to use a raider battalion. They didn't, and Edson ran into the same thing where he was. They didn't know how to use them. But he would explain to us, and stay ready, because we're going to get a job. There was a great big stand, you know, like a football stand, and all the brass was up there, you know, admirals, generals, you couldn't believe it, Army, Navy, Air Force, everything. They were sitting there like they were going to watch us perform, like we were performing monkeys. Well, it was a maneuver, and we had to take it seriously. Carlson said, we're going to do this exactly the way we would pull a raid anywhere. We're going to get to Lualua Lake, and we're going to take it. Well, we believed anything he told us. So we made our landing, and it was like somebody was shooting a movie. You know, here we're making a landing, and over here, just off the scene, there's admirals and generals and all these, and senators and what have you, watching us. And we land, and there is a line of, I don't know, they must have had 2,000 sailors, marines, soldiers, all armed with live ammunition. And we landed and started sneaking past the barbed wire. Well, it was daylight, and they could see how we cut the barbed wire and what we did and all that. But we did it in a way that it wouldn't set off any alarms, and that was logical. They had referees, and we had done it properly. We went inside the barbed wire, and then we camped in there. Al Flores, who was one of my two closest buddies in the Raiders, he was here from Los Angeles, and I were both probably the darkest guys in our company. He was a Mexican kid. So we were assigned the job. We carried civilian clothes in our pack, and we were assigned a job of becoming civilians as soon as possible, getting away and going forward and scouting out this area. I was a scout, that's what we did, and machine gunners. So we got into our clothes and, you know, dressed like civilians, sneaked off under the bushes and all that, and made our way towards Lualua and began mapping everything. I won't tell you our story because that's too complicated, but we ended up being chased by the MPs and really having literally to run for our lives because they were trying to kill us. They thought we were real spies. Meanwhile, there were 800 Marines there, you know, Raiders. And that night, as soon as it got to be night, we had all the campfires and everything. The old man sent the advanced troops, and they began to cut like a rabbit hole under the brush. It was cactus, you know, like this kind of cactus you see in the cowboy movies. And they began to cut a hole through the cactus, like a rabbit hole, and all 800 Marines went through that little tunnel, through the cactus, through the grass, and out of sight. And in the morning, but it came morning, there wasn't a Marine left there. There wasn't a Raider left. This guy said, "Where did they go? Where'd they go?" And this is all true. I know it sounds fantastic. Carlson then started the guys going through the mountain, through the roughest terrain you can imagine, and they were to approach Lualua from behind. And behind there was a huge swamp, and it wasn't guarded because all the guards were in front. They had barbed wire, they had a constant patrol around the camp, and the Raiders went around the back, crossed, laid down planks, crossed, got into the Lualua, grabbed the colonel at gunpoint, the guy that was in charge, grabbed all the guards, bound them up, you know, tied them up at gunpoint and all that, and we took over the whole place. And then just for good measure, the old man had us take the trucks and you know, the vehicles, and then go over to a nearby airport, and then we took stickers that had a Raider picture on them and stuck them on all the airplanes, and it said, "Your airplane has just been blown up." Man, I tell you, there was such an uproar the following day. And I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that endeared Carlson to the high command. We had completely taken over everything, and we had tied them up like pigs, you know, and they were enraged. The high command was just enraged. I mean, Carlson couldn't do anything right after that, except with Papa Nimitz. And we were totally isolated from everybody. We had nothing. You know, we just lived like on nothing, practically. And while we were waiting for employment, and that employment, you know, came around, you know, it was Guadalcanal, had been invaded, and we were finally, we got an assignment to go into Guadalcanal and help, you know, the effort there. The Marines were very hard pressed. You know, they've done a wonderful job, but I mean, they were virtually isolated too.
That concludes part one of Bill Lansford's story. In the next episode, he recounts his dramatic exploits in the battle for Guadalcanal and beyond. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for watching, and by doing so, honoring those who've served. This program was produced by Evergreen Podcasts and Documentary.tv. I'm your host, Ken Harbaugh. If you've enjoyed this episode, please comment, share, and subscribe below.